This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. 2 weeks ago, Florence Green, the last known surviving veteran of World War I, died. She'd been a waitress in Britain's Royal Air Force. The story of that war that was to end all wars now lives on in historic accounts, novels, poems, and pictures. Millions of British and American viewers recently got a glimpse of the brutality on PBS's popular Downton Abbey series.
Good news. We've been relieved today by the Devons. The men can finally get some rest. I've got a few days' leave coming to me.
What will you do with them, sir?
London first. Remind myself what real food tastes like.
The prevailing historical narrative is that the trenches were slaughtering troughs and that the Great War was inevitable, a percolating crisis waiting for a catalyst. Jack Beattie explores new scholarship to offer contrary views in a new book called The Lost History of 1914, The Year the Great War Began. In it, he chronicles some largely forgotten events and players that could have derailed war and argues that trench warfare saved lives. Jack is news analyst for NPR's On Point and author of The Rascal King, The Age of Betrayal, and other books. He joins us from his home in Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack Beattie, so great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Virginia, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, in school, we learned that the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of June of 1914 was the spark that ignited war in Europe. You argue against the historical inevitability of it and say it's a doctrine for history without people. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that the idea that there are deep structures that just produce events, and one historian has said of that assassination, if it hadn't been that, it would have been something else. War was just inevitable. That assumes that actions of human beings, even actions, arbitrary actions, even whims, even, you know, fantasies, can't derail history. And of course, we know that's just not true. For example, the Archduke went to Sarajevo partly because the day he was killed, the 28th of June, was the anniversary of his wedding, and because he could give his wife what she never got otherwise, Sophie, first-class treatment. She was always treated as a second-class citizen back home, but on an official trip, she would be treated well. So it was love that got him to go there. I mean, how do you calculate that in any idea of historical inevitability?
Well, you give us some new views of what was going on for the great powers leading up to 1914, many roiling with domestic tensions. Maybe the best example is in Britain. What was going on there?
Well, Britain was on the verge of civil war, and that's no exaggeration. The issue was Ireland, of course, the damnable question. Specifically, should Ireland have home rule? Should it be ruled from, you know, in local matters from a parliament in Dublin? And to the Protestants in Ulster, the north of Ireland, home rule was Rome rule. They said, we're not going to, you know, live under the Catholic Church. And they raised an army of several hundred thousand people. They were drilling, and they said, if you go ahead to the Liberal government and push home rule forward, pass it in the summer of 1914, we are going to rebel. Meanwhile, the Catholics in the south raised their own army to sort of defend their co-religionists in the north, and you had these two armies ready to fight. And it came down to the last days of July when finally war, it was almost a race between civil war and war in Europe. War in Europe just won. And the Prime Minister Asquith said, thank God, the ways of Providence are mysterious. War has saved us from civil war. Better kill the Huns. Than one another.
Oh, boy. And the entrenched political powers in Europe, you write about them mistaking democratization for revolution, especially in Germany, let's say. What do you mean by that? What was going on?
Well, what was going on was that every year the Social Democratic Party, the largest party in the Reichstag in Germany, was getting more powerful and had nearly had a majority. And the establishment in Germany, the Junker aristocrats, the industrialists, the military, feared that the day would come when they would have a majority and through simply democracy, change the entire setup to the detriment of the vested interests. And there was fear, there was a sense in Germany, better war than just waiting around and having our whole world set at naught by these socialists. Mm-hmm. And they thought, of course, the socialists were aiming at revolution. Far from it. They were aiming at essentially what Germany has today, a social welfare state. But, of course, to the alarmed right wing of Prussia, it didn't look that way. And some historians think that the Germans actually welcomed the war, sought it to escape from this domestic crisis.
Nearly 100 years after it began, we're talking about World War I with Jack Beatty, news analyst for NPR's On Point and author of several books, most recently The Lost History of 1914, which, unlike the many books that track the path to war, he maps paths leading away from it. Jack, I want to talk to you quickly about France, because you open up a fascinating case that had huge implications for the path the government took that I'd never heard of. If you could unpack it for us quickly, the case of Madame Caillaux.
Madame Caillaux, she was the wife of the finance minister, Joseph Caillaux. In March of 1914, she assassinated the editor, shot dead the editor of Le Figaro, because he was going to publish love letters, she felt. These would, that written to her by her husband when they were each married to other people. She said, this would be an affront to my woman's honor. My daughter would see me in a way no daughter should see her mother. She was tried for this, and the Paris jury acquitted her. The trial came in the last days of July, just as newsboys were yelling, you know, war in Austria sends Serbia an ultimatum. And if she hadn't killed Caillaux, if she hadn't killed Calmette, the editor of Figaro, her husband would have been premier. If he had been premier, his whole policy was détente with Germany, and his foreign minister would have been the great socialist Jean Jaurès, whose would be like making Martin Luther King Secretary of State. Mm. He was the great pacifist of the age, and he said clearly in the last days of July, better saving the peace of Europe than honoring our treaty with Russia. And it was the treaty with Russia that compelled France to enter the war. So here's one of the great what-ifs. Her bullets, she shot him five, Calmette five times, really was among the most decisive of that year.
If only. And in the estimates of some 60 to 70 million fighting forces mobilized around Europe during the Great War, as the Brits call it, or World War I, more than 9 million killed. But you write that trench warfare actually saved lives.
Yes, the war was at its bloodiest when the armies were out in the open. That's because weaponry had changed, the machine gun specifically. And the trenches were an answer to that. You went underground to save yourself. It's when you raised up and tried to attack that you were slaughtered. So the trenches really represented a victory of life over death. And the brass on both sides feared that this would sap the will to fight. And they went to great lengths to try to, activate that will by having trench raids, by making life as miserable as possible in the trenches. But the sides worked out a kind of live and let live procedure between them that allowed them to coexist. And so these trenches were, and the war became bloody again in 1918 when the armies went on the offensive. So it was when they were under that they were safer. When they rose up, They were targets.
So this if only book, if only war was delayed for a month, if only Jaurès would have been in power, what are you doing by challenging this narrative of inevitability about World War I?
Well, I'm trying to show how contingent the war was. I mean, the emphasis by historians has been on all these deep causes, from the psyche to economics to the alliance system. And I'm saying, wait a minute. I mean, there are other factors here. And really, my motto is from Herodotus: very few things happen at the right time, and others do not happen at all. That, I think, is the law of history, that everything is contingency and timing, and what happens at the right time or what doesn't happen at all. And I try to show again and again that if only these little events, seemingly small events within the belligerent powers had happened at the right time, there would have been no war then. And if no war then, perhaps no war at all.
Jack Beatty, I want to thank you so much for your impassioned reading of this book today.
Thank you so much.
Jack Beatty, news analyst for NPR's On Point. He's author of several books, including The Rascal King and editor of Colossus, How the Corporation Changed America. We have more on his new book, The Lost History of 1914, The Year the Great War Began, at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for the end of Money. That's in just a moment when Word of Mouth continues from NHPR.
Thank you.